Morning, ladies and gentlemen. The first case this morning is Thomas Rosenbaum versus Bo White.
Hello, my name is Adam Davis, and I am here with co-counsel Andrea Germano. I'm with the law firm of Davis and Sarbanoff, and I represent the appellant in this case. This case is a case that arises out of numerous claims from a group of investors that invested with an individual in Marion, Indiana. It's a little bit more complex than that, but what ended up ultimately happening was a summary judgment was filed in the lower courts by the defendants in the case, and it was countered with a counter motion for summary judgments by the plaintiffs. And what ended up happening was the judge ruled in favor of the defendants, and this appeal arose from that. Now, the facts that I believe are pertinent to this is that our attorneys are involved. What happened is there's about 15 or more individuals and a few entities in the state of Michigan and various other areas that were solicited by an individual that was named Chad Siebold. Chad Siebold was the son of the mayor of Marion, Indiana. I'm sorry, was the brother of the mayor of Marion, Indiana. He's a well-known figure skater, I think an Olympic one at that.
Who, the mayor or him?
Oh, thank you. The mayor. In fact, that's actually a good point. The son didn't really do much of anything. The son had left the city of Marion for a long period of time, and then all of a sudden there was news of an influx of a big distribution center that was going to go in to Marion, Indiana, and that it was going to create thousands of jobs. Well, Marion, Indiana suffered from dilapidated homes. So this was Mr. Siebold's Jr., so we'll call him Chad. This was Chad Siebold's opportunity to go back home and make a name for himself, because he had dealt in houses and investments, and he was a broker. So what ended up happening is Chad went back home, and Chad, now that his brother was the newly elected mayor, he made his home in Marion, and he all of a sudden started a company called Cetron LLC, and he started doing commercial properties, flipping them, renting them, selling them. And then he got the idea of raising money. So he needed to solicit investors. So what he chose to do was he got attorneys that he wanted to have involved. He got loan brokers. He obtained insurance people. He obtained construction companies, construction crews, and the mayor. And what he did was he put together what he referred to as an offering circular. And they had a seminar in Marion, Indiana, and I believe it was located in the governor's, in the mayor's office in their conference room. They invited all of these individuals out. At that time, I believe that there were five individual investors that are in this case. He invited a gentleman by the name of Victor Wayne. He invited a couple by the name of the Sanduskys. And he also invited an individual by the name of Thomas Rosenbaum.
How many of these people, plaintiffs, I guess, who were what they call investment advisors?
There are two individuals in this case that are investment brokers, just like Chad.
Now, Wayne was one of them, I guess.
Wayne Siebold was the mayor. Chad.
I said Wayne, W-H-A-N-G. It's one of your.
Wayne, yes, sir.
Wasn't he
He was an investment broker, yes,
okay.
Sir.
Okay. There was another one. I don't remember who.
There was another individual by the name of Ray Leggett, and they represent two sides. They had no idea of each other. Wang brought himself and his clients, and Ray brought himself and his clients, and they were not aware of each other until a later date and time.
Mm-hmm. Well, I assume when they're investment advisors, I guess they take some cognizance of what's going on and all of this arrangement you put together. They seem to be kind of independent folks that should know what they're doing. They're advising others.
If your point is that they have a higher standard of care, yes, they do.
No, higher knowledge too.
I don't believe that. With regard to investments, yes. With regard to investments in real estate, I'm not certain on that.
Okay, well, go ahead. I just wanted to clear that up.
All right. So let's deal with one group, the Wang Group. The Wang Group, Victor Wang, brought a few of his clients. They all sat there, and they were presented with the Citron team. And this is the group that I'm talking about. We're talking about Wayne Siebold. We're talking about Lupe Cadena, who was the construction crew. We're talking about Chad's father was also there. And they also had a gentleman by the name of Bojack White. Bojack White is the attorney. When this case went forward, there are three individuals that are actually here as the appellees. We have Bojack White, James Beeman, and the law firm. And we've referred to them as Citron Counsel throughout this litigation. We referred to the appellants as the Citron investors. Yes, sir.
Obviously, you all have at least viable claims or had viable claims against Mr. Siebold and the companies.
Yes, sir.
As I understand it, the basic challenge is whether you can do anything with the attorney malpractice policy here. That is a practical matter. That's what we're talking about.
Ultimately, we have about
okay.
seven. Yes, sir.
And then, as I understand it, you don't have any of these plaintiffs testifying that White told them really anything directly about being their counsel. Correct?
No, sir. That is not correct.
Okay.
Would you like me to go in?
Where am I wrong?
Okay. Yes, sir. Well, first, I'll name the individuals, and then I'll name the circumstances. Wang was in...
I'm talking about with White telling the investors, I'm your lawyer.
Yes. Yes,
not with nods promising, I'm your lawyer.
Yes, we do, sir.
Okay, where's that evidence?
All right. And this is an interesting point. After the first seminar that was a Wang and his client's seminar, individuals approached Mr. White after the seminar was over, and Mr. White confirmed to the Sanduskys and to Rosenbaum that he, in fact, was their counsel.
What words did he use, according to them?
Let me turn to that spot, sir. Because the court actually quoted them in their order as what the court felt that they had done. For example, on page 11 of the court's order, it states the district court states that Mr. Rosenbaum talked to White briefly after the presentation to introduce himself. According to Mr. Rosenbaum, White gave him a business card and indicated that he would be representing the investor group. However, in our case, we cited Exhibit 15 at page 47 to 49, and we believe that that tells a much more in-depth story as to what actually occurred. And I can go to that page if you'd like me, or I could do it off of memory.
This is not a memory test.
Yes, sir. It's an exact word, so I'm going to go
there. We're talking about pivotal evidence for your case.
Yes, sir. So on page... If we turn to Exhibit 15 at page 47 through 49, and by the way, what we did was this morning I went through this, and every single one of these tabs is what White told these people or how they...
That's great, but we don't have those tabs, and we don't have
yes,
Exhibit 15
I just want to point out real quick, too, that in our brief on page 11, it has... every single one of these tabs specified
okay.
by site. But
okay.
on Exhibit 15, page 47, the talk is of this. What was the conversation? It was very brief. I just introduced myself to him, and he gave me his business card and told me that if I had any questions, to give him a call, that he's representing the investors group. That's the part that the court chose to focus on. But
did you ever have any questions and give him a call?
No, that White was representing the investor group, making it appear that White was representing
the... Yeah, what I'm saying is that he gave him a card. I guess he was there, and I didn't see the video. But did any of these investors ever call White and say what's going on or something?
Yes, sir. Three of them did. If I could go through these two paragraphs real quick, I'll touch right on that just so I don't lose the flow, or I could go right through that. Then it says, he indicated on the video that I reviewed and remembered because I asked some questions. I was one of the questions in there. And I had some questions during the presentation about conflict of interest. Chad was just very clear, and he was clear in stating, Chad was just very, very clear in stating that this law firm and Bo White represents the investors. I mean, he said he represents, and he's looking out for our welfare. They're looking out for our welfare, and they're advising the company on how to run the investment company. That was what I got out of our meeting.
Is Chad talking?
Well, that was it was not. I said, and you said Chad was very clear. He was clear with regard to the April or 9, 2005 meeting, yes. And I didn't see Bo White jump up and say, no, 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 now he's going back. And he was standing there next time to him, listening to him say, I took that to mean that he acknowledged that it is exactly what he was there for. And you said that you believe that he was representing the investor group, and who was that? And then he goes in, well, the people potentially who would invest, the Citron investors, number one, LLC. What he was proposing was to have a group of investors that would invest in X number of properties. Once he raised that and got all of the investments in place, he was going to start, well, it starts going into a different part. But it's clear that he was at one time referring to Chad, and then he flipped, and he told me that. And he was the one that represented that to me.
He is white, I presume?
Yes, on lines 21 through 25, Chad was just very, very clear and stating that this law firm and Bo White represents the investors. I mean, he said he represents, and he's looking out for our welfare. That was the conversation that took place after. And there's an additional citation. I'm sorry, sir?
That sounds pretty ambiguous.
Well, it was the deposition that was taken, but if you read it in conjunction, we can go to then on page 54. Right. One moment, Your Honor. Oh, it's back here. And then
is it the plaintiff's theory, Mr. Davis, that Mr. White and his law firm had an attorney-client relationship as of that seminar with anybody who attended?
Absolutely not. Well, I mean, we know that he had an attorney-client relationship with Chad. We know he had an attorney-client relationship with the Citron companies that existed at the time. But as for at that moment in time, no.
Because when do you think it arose with your clients?
I believe that for each client that was going into this package deal, I believe that the attorney-client relationship arose once they invested.
With the check?
The check however the funds were transferred.
Okay. You all have asserted several times in your brief fairly vigorously that your case is so strong because Attorney White admitted it would have been reasonable for the investors to believe that they would have an attorney-client relationship with him and his firm. And the testimony that you've cited was addressed specifically by the district court, who quoted the deposition testimony. By my count, in the 8 or 9 lines of the question, there are 3 distinct questions, the last 2 of which point in opposite directions. There's a no answer would have exactly the opposite meaning. And so given that testimony, how can you rely on that as evidence that White admitted, in essence, that your clients would have been acting reasonably in relying upon what he was saying?
I think that the section that you're referring to is page 232 of the depositions, and you're referring to the last few lines of that.
I
believe that in context, it's absolutely crystal clear. And I will say this before I go into it. If it's not crystal clear and it has a dual meaning, the inference are supposed to be drawn in our favor.
Do you think in summary you can avoid summary judgment by asking two contradictory questions, creating the ambiguity yourself?
Oh, no, absolutely.
The last two questions there, Mr. Davis. Could you see how a person could believe that we're giving money to the company and the company spending money on the attorneys? I think he is my attorney. A no answer to that would be favorable to the defense. A yes answer would be favorable to you.
Yes,
next, without an answer, do you think that would be completely unreasonable? A yes answer would be favorable to the defense, and a no answer would be favorable to you.
I absolutely agree with that.
The answer, I don't see that, no. I mean,
I totally
that
understand.
Questioning creates the ambiguity, and that can't be used to defeat summary judgment.
That cannot be used to defeat summary judgment. Well, what is missing here is that when you take a deposition and you're actually part of it, and I recall there being like a 15-second break, and I don't know why it didn't get on a different line, but that's neither here nor there. I think if you clearly read page 230 leading up to 232, there's no way that it could be any other
answer. Let me put it this way to you, Mr. Davis. Given the district court's point-blank destruction of that argument, I don't see how you could assert, without the explanation you're providing today, repeatedly in your brief, that White admitted your clients were acting reasonably and relying on him.
I don't believe that the court destroyed the argument. I think that the court improperly believed that it destroyed the argument. I think that if you look, yes, sir. And I'm not trying to be disrespectful, but my position is that if you look on page 230, we went through a series of every line. Was that a correct statement? No, it was not correct. Was that a correct statement? No, it was not. Could you see
suggest to you, Mr. Davis, is that given the district court's direct response that, at least to my eyes, pretty thoroughly discounts your reliance on White's testimony, you may disagree with the district court. You may even be right. But you've got to explain and support why you're right rather than just pretend that this didn't happen and assume that we're not going to check the testimony.
Your Honor, first of all, our reliance on that is our reliance on whether or not Bojack White believes that his actions were reasonable or not reasonable is not the sum total of our case. In fact, I don't believe that it really is. It really pushes the burden one way or the other. It's nice to have the person that you're in a lawsuit with admit that his act was unreasonable. It seems to add something to it. But as we go through
the
entire...
If it happened, that would have been true.
Correct.
So why don't you go on with other evidence?
But you'll know... Yes, sir. So I'll just add this, but you'll notice in the reply brief, or in the response brief, White never, ever filed an affidavit or any other document that he specifically said that's not what he meant. Our reliance on whether or not an attorney-client relationship existed here is based on the fact that these individuals were brought to Marion. This individual got in front of these people, and he chose, it's very important that you see the DVD. You can be standing here as an attorney, and you have the person that walks up next to you, and that person listens as you state, word for word.
We saw what he said.
What he said was he walked up saying almost shoulder to shoulder with Chad Siebold in front of a group of investors in a situation that he created with his Citron team, with everybody around him. And he said, this is Chad speaking. I think the other important thing here is that you've got to remember that Citron Counsel, and I'm referring to Bo, doesn't just represent Siebold. A lot of these are in brackets on page 16. Citron Counsel represents the Citron Investor Companies. I want to stop there for 1 second. The actual testimony says Citron Holding Group or Citron Holdings LLC. The reason it says that is because at that time, that was the only Citron investment company. And the first slide that you'll look at, which is located in the materials at 61, I'm sorry, at 60, at 57, I'm sorry. The first slide at 57 shows that it's Cetron Property Holdings. So I think the other important thing here is that you've got to remember that it's Cetron Council doesn't just represent Siebold. Cetron Council represents the Cetron investment companies. That means that Cetron Council represents the Cetron investors as well. So Cetron Council is not just looking out for Siebold's best interests, but Cetron Council is looking out for the Cetron investors' best interests as well, and my best interest as also as a partner in this group. It's not like I don't want the Cetron investors to get the impression that Cetron Council are setting the Cetron investment scheme up to where the Cetron investment scheme only benefits me and that the Cetron investors are going to be left hanging in the breeze.
That's all Siebold, right?
No, it's not, Your Honor.
Who were you quoting?
I was quoting Siebold.
Okay.
But that doesn't
your
mean
red light is on. But could I ask you very briefly to address the question of the significance of the disclaimer in the investment document that all of the plaintiffs signed, that they had consulted with their and were relying on their own counsel?
Yes, sir. I don't believe it is of any significance. The disclaimer provides, it's the boilerplate disclaimer that everybody that signs the agreement has consulted with their own accountants and their own attorneys. The only problem is when we deposed Jim Beeman, we asked him why that was in there. And Jim Beeman's testimony, and I'm not going to quote it verbatim, but it was simply, that's my form boilerplate agreement. It's in all of them. It was not put in there because to distinguish between the investors. In fact, Chad Siebold signed the agreement, and he admits that he's...
It's his form agreement. He puts it in all of them for the same reason.
Your Honor?
That everybody's supposed to read this stuff when they put their money in. And I'm just frankly perplexed at what, other than this first encounter, White or anyone else had anything to do with what went on in this company.
Yes, sir.
They set up the documents, which apparently set up a proper LLC, which, as I think it was quoted, somebody said, it only risk is your investment. In other words, if somebody falls off and gets injured on the job and that sort of thing and they sue the company, the investor isn't vulnerable to that. That's what that means, and that it's only their investment was risk. Now, as I understand it, they put in $1,000 and then signed personal guarantees for $400,000. Is that right?
No, sir.
What did they do?
They put in their about 60. Some put in $60,000 from their IRA. Some put in $220,000.
Okay, so they put in cash.
Yes, sir.
But so they had these investments because I didn't know. It doesn't matter. Whatever they put in.
It does not matter. I agree.
I don't know what they did once they put that in, who they consulted with, or did they talk to anybody besides Siebold?
They didn't need to because they believed that they had counsel.
Counsel doing what?
They believed that they had...
Saying the house isn't repaired or found out it had an electrical problem and therefore it's not worth anything? Well, where's the loss?
I can put that out. Had they had proper counsel, they could have done a numerous amount of things. For example, in our brief, there's about two pages that talk about all the things that were supposed to be done that were talked about at the seminar but never made their way into the documents.
That the lawyer was supposed to do?
A lawyer was supposed to do, if that's what our argument is. This lawyer was supposed to do it because he agreed to do it. However, if an attorney reviewed this, they would not give Chad Siebold carte blanche control over $1 million in cash. They might have required countersigning. They might have required separate companies.
I'm amazed at Wang and these other investment advisors that are supposed to be some sort of expertise, and Wang brings a bunch of people to a meeting. And I don't know. I know Siebold's settled whatever he did.
Siebel went into bankruptcy
and turned whatever property was there over to somebody. And
I don't think that it's surprising.
This is a real bad investment.
That is the whole purpose of
securities. And then end of market turned severely.
That is the purpose of securities law. When you said earlier that all you have at risk is your investment, that's all you ever have at risk in these.
Well,
and that's a lot.
Okay.
I mean, if we're talking about I don't think anybody was concerned really about personal liability. They were concerned about putting their money with an individual whom they have no formal association with. However, here's the mayor. Here's an attorney that's getting up, and they're all in the same room together. They presented a pretty play.
Okay, that answers my question. Thanks.
Yes, sir.
Your time has expired. We'll see where we go with your opponent. How much time would... You can leave it there. We'll give you an additional 5 minutes to start with. So.
Good morning. Phil Calamaris for the appellees. I wanted to answer a few quick questions. Yes, Your Honor, they would have Series 7 licenses, which means that they have to take a test, and which means they have to know a lot more about securities and about general investing as investment advisors. Keep in mind that one of the allegations that the appellants make in this case is that somehow that my clients, by not bringing this into stronger securities law, somehow committed malpractice. Well, as people who form corporations, avoiding a statute is a part of the business. These are LLCs that conversations were made to map out these investments at a certain level. These are not public offerings. These are not things that would have triggered the particularized laws if, in fact, Mr. Siebold had done things the way they would, the way they were originally talked about. I think that there's some things that there's some other things I would like to answer. Judge, to your question, never was there an express statement by my client saying, I am your lawyers. The best they can get is some conversation at that April 2005 meeting. But as the district court pointed out, even at that point, we have nobody who's invested yet. There's no money spent. There's no corporations formed. And there's no guarantee to Mr. White that he's even going to continue to be the lawyer. And this was brought up by the district court also when you're talking about fraud. What's the future act? I mean, what we heard from counsel was that at the time of the meeting, there was no attorney-client relationship. It was in the future sometime when these people signed on that they then argued that an attorney-client relationship started. There were no, to my recollection, I could be wrong, but there were no investors that I recall that actually paid one dime before my clients had completed the tasks that they were assigned to do.
Was there any contact with any of the investors with your client?
Well, Judge, let me just run down...
Other than this first encounter.
Well, let me just run down the list for you real quick, because I think it's significant, okay? At the April meeting, you had Rosenbaum, you had Sandusky, and you had Wang. And you had the conversations that if you watched the video, you saw what Mr. White said. And you have a short interval after that where Sandusky did not talk to them. Wang was at the meeting prior to the seminar. And his own testimony was that Chad wanted him there to show that he had lawyers hired to do the paperwork. And Rosenbaum essentially said, I'm there. It's in the district court's opinion. I think he pointed out on page 11. Very, very minimal. Now, after that, the only other direct contact with my clients were two phone call attempts. And Leggett met White once in his office. And there's just a little snippet about that. That Leggett said something like, so you're the guy watching out for us, and Bo didn't say anything specific to the back of that. Now, here's the thing, is that as to Kazakums, as to the Jones Trust, Sexton, Stern, Method, Tennyson, Liskowski, Orwell, Hood, Smolsky, Taney, no contact, no advice, no payment, no nothing. And to some of these people, they didn't even know who these lawyers were until after the lawsuits were filed. Now, remember that an attorney-client relationship has to have two prongs. And this is one, and I'll confess that I try, when I'm doing my briefs and when I'm doing my argument, to be value-added to the district court if I'm trying to help to sustain a district court opinion. The problem with Judge Brinkman is that she writes really thorough opinions. So I always feel like I'm just parroting whatever she said, because she went through each and every one of these contacts, and she went through each and every one of these counts. But what we have to remember is that none of these people had a retainer agreement, which is not, and again, I'm not saying these are necessary, but let's look at what we do know. We do know that none of these people had anything resembling continuous contact. We know that none of these people paid a dime for this. We know that none of these people actually got any advice. What they're saying is that we want you to believe that they committed malpractice by letting us think that they may continue to have been our attorneys during this process. Well, and Judge Brinkman pointed out is that what you're saying is that somehow a lawyer, because they form two corporations, and keep in mind that one of these two corporations, the most important corporation, Siebel never used. There was never any money that went into it. There was never any property that went into it. If we're going to say that lawyers, once they form a corporation, are now responsible for everything that corporation does or everything anybody says about that corporation, or if the people who hired us and who control whether we do their work keep using our name as if we're being used more, what we've done is create an open-ended opportunity for anyone to sue if we ever did any work. As lawyers, we do not accompany this work to the bitter end. A lawyer is hired to do work, and when that lawyer finishes that work, he stands ready to be called upon again. In this case, Mr. Siebel chose to have us form two corporations and to talk to us about some of his ideas, and to do one promissory note and to do one other document.
Who prepared the operating agreement?
Beeman did. And Jim prepared two operating agreements, two articles of organization. He filed them with the state. He did a promissory note that was an unsecured promissory note, and he did one other document, Judge, in between there. Now, we cannot, as lawyers, make people follow our advice. We cannot, as lawyers, make people continue to use us. And for example, when you're arguing about whether we have intent, whether we have scienter, we have any of these things, I am sure my clients would have loved to have been hired to do more work than they were asked to do. And certainly it seems a little odd that we get to be sued for the work that we didn't do when we weren't asked to do that work. I find
trouble. Mr. Calabrese, let me ask you if I could.
Sure, Your Honor.
There was at least some direct contact between White and some of the investors. Plaintiffs are relying, at least in part, on the standard of care, if I may use that phrase, embodied in Rule 4.3, the Rules of Professional Conduct, for dealing with unrepresented persons. That is, as I understand the argument, if White did not intend to be representing these investors, why didn't he have an obligation under Rule 4.3 to make the status of the situation clear to them?
Well, that's an interesting question, Judge, because you'd have to narrow that down to only the people who were actually at that meeting if you wanted to do that.
I'm doing that.
Nothing. Okay, so let's take a look at the people who were there. What did he really say when he was there? Because what I find is I don't find anything particularly unclear. I think at that time, White's thinking to himself, I would like to represent these people. I've been called upon by Chad Siebel to do certain things, which we have done.
This is an interesting bit of speculation, but it's not really in the record. And we have to view this through a summary judgment lens. What we do have on the record is Siebel saying, with White at his side, White and his firm are looking out for you, and White nodding along. Okay? Now, why doesn't White have an obligation in that situation to make clear we actually are counsel to the corporations or the LLCs, not to the individual investors?
Well, I think the district court addressed that, and I don't know that I have a great deal of quibble with how she dealt with it, saying you have to contextualize his failure to be more clear.
And why isn't that a jury argument?
Well, I don't. Well, for one thing, is that we already have a summary judgment, so I'm not sure that the court can go.
No, you don't understand my question. We have to view that evidence in the light reasonably most favorable to the non-moving parties, the plaintiffs. And when you start saying, well, to explain this away, we have to contextualize it, that sounds more like an argument that you would have to make to a jury, not to win summary judgment.
Well no, Your Honor. One is because after summary judgment is granted, this court is not, even as with a de novo review, you're not supposed to be looking for minor scintilla. And that's already been pointed out to the court. But when you look at what was said...
Do you think I didn't understand that? My point is that one can argue. Plaintiffs are making this argument. I'm asking you to tell me what's wrong with this rather than to reject the question.
Okay.
All right?
All right.
The argument is White allowed Siebold to create the impression that White was going to be the attorney for at least several of these investors and did nothing to dispel that impression. Why isn't that a problem under Rule 4.3? And if you tell me you have to contextualize things, that starts to sound like you want me to view the evidence in the light reasonably most favorable to the defendants.
Okay, well, the latter part I disagree, but I won't use that word then. I will not use contextualize. I think it is even safe to assume that at that moment, White viewed his job as a lawyer for the corporation to extend in some small finger.
So he had no clue, so he did not understand the scope of his responsibilities as a representative, as counsel to the business entities?
Well, but Judge, there are certain duties that a lawyer has to shareholders who, again, at that moment, there are no shareholders. Right? At that moment, there are no shareholders because there are no corporations. But the lawyer at that moment said, has a duty to the shareholders generally to operate positively on behalf of the corporation, to form the documents correctly.
Is that duty enforceable by the individual shareholders?
Well, that's one of the arguments that it is not, except in very certain circumstances. And none of those circumstances, in my view, come here. I think that this is one of the problems when you look at shareholder cases, is what is this ethereal duty that extends as a part of your duty to the corporation? And again, at this point, we haven't even formed corporations. When he lets Chad Siebold say what Chad Siebold expects White's relationship to be. Remember, at this point, they've had two meetings where they've talked about how they want to form this. They haven't formed any corporations. They haven't firmed up anything. It's kind of like when you're saying, okay, here's the personal trainer I'm going to hire for all my friends. And then you choose not to have that personal trainer continue to come. Judge, in fact, the point I would like to make is that if you want to take that position, you in essence want to suggest that somehow White knew that Siebold wasn't going to continue to use him. And I don't think that's the case. There hasn't been any evidence of that.
What, in your view, you said a minute ago that a corporation counsel does have duties to shareholders. What are those duties?
Well, I think, for example, for formation things. And again, the individual duty would be based principally on the way in which the person is used. But for example, in the corporate formation, if a person who asks a lawyer to do a corporate formation asks that lawyer to do a sub S election, and that lawyer does not do a sub S election and it stays a C, now there's a very serious difference in how the individual shareholder's tax treatment is going to occur. You see what I mean? That's an obligation that he's doing for the corporation.
Any other examples? Where the attorney for the corporation has a duty to an individual shareholder.
Some of the finer details of stock legends would be another one.
What in this case would, I guess, under the circumstances, once these corporations are set up the way they were, I guess they apparently didn't use one, what would an investor expect a lawyer to be doing after that? What I'm looking, I look at it from the investor's point of view. Okay, this lawyer, as I understand it, nobody actually called for legal advice or a legal opinion about what's going on and whether or not the thing, whatever this business is succeeding. I guess looking at it from a former practitioner, which all of us were at some point, what if I set up a corporation and then sometime later I get a call from a shareholder who's saying, we're losing money or something. I'm not sure what a lawyer would be expected to, how we respond, other than saying, I don't know.
Well, a couple of things, Judge. For one is that you have to keep in mind, and Judge, this may respond to some of your, a little bit to what I think you're thinking, and is that these lawyers didn't actually know whether or not these corporations were actually used and whether anyone of those people who were at that initial meeting ever even invested. And this is the problem with the practitioner. I mean, if you think back to when you were working in your old firm and you formed a corporation, did you feel obligated to be the policeman? Because if you look at what I think the plaintiffs are arguing in this case is they wanted Bo White to be the and Jim Beeman to be the policeman for Chad Siebold.
See, what I don't understand with Siebold, I don't understand what he was doing. He recited all of these things. He had these various people with expertise, obviously contractors, et cetera, et cetera. So there's supposedly a whole group of people who are going to rehab houses and make money after they improve them, that sort of thing. I guess it's sort of a rhetorical question. What involvement does a lawyer have in rehabbing houses and having various people do their jobs and make sure that they're making a profit, because it obviously didn't work?
Well, if you take as...
And I'm asking this rhetorically because, as a practitioner, I don't know. Well, I don't know the answer. I don't know if I'm supposed to do anything.
I don't think that what the plaintiffs say in their complaint they wanted this firm to do is something that would be normal. But it would be normal, for example, in an LLC where they're buying houses and fixing them up and renting them. Remember up at Notre Dame, there was a huge of that in the West neighborhood. You would have that lawyer writing leases. You would have that lawyer looking at construction contracts between people. Those are the kind of things that a lawyer would be doing. A lawyer would not be making...
None of this went on, in other words.
Well, no, but they were never called upon to do that.
That's what I'm asking.
Yeah, they were never called upon to do
that. What I'm trying to do is draw a line here and see where they've alleged they went past that line. And if they're drawing up leases, if you're drawing up construction contracts, if you're drawing up buy-sell agreements, I don't know what, a whole lot of other things that could go on subsequent to the formation of these two entities and, I guess, the operating agreement. If there's nothing beyond that you can recite, and I guess if he comes back, maybe he can say something, where there really was some ongoing legal relationship other than setting up these entities.
Yes, Your Honor, there wasn't. As I said,
okay,
Mr. Beeman did...
that's your answer. There was not.
Well, there were two things that Beeman did. And again, their work stopped in May or June of 2005. Beeman did a promissory note. Siebold called and said, okay, you've set these two operations. He said, had him do a promissory note and had him do a purchase agreement or an offering agreement. That's it. There were no calls by any of these people. There was no interaction by any of these plaintiffs after this initial meeting.
So they did.
There were two unreturned calls.
He did two things that require a lawyer to do a specific thing. I assume he paid the lawyer for doing those two things.
Yes.
And that's it.
Right. And none of these other people, and those were paid by Siebel's companies. They were not paid by any of these individuals. None of these individuals had phone calls or correspondence or letters or advice or parley of any sort. Of any sort. And after it had all hit the fan and the money was gone and Chad couldn't be get a hold of, there were two investors who made calls to the firm trying to get a hold of Siebel. Neither of those calls were returned.
All right. Well, that answers my question.
That's it. Right? I believe that if the court looks at the pieces that the appellants put forward as plaintiffs, that they have not met their burden to follow these counts. They have not shown scienter. They have not shown fraud. They have not shown a sufficient indicia to create an ongoing attorney-client relationship. And they've said that we do not believe there was an attorney-client relationship formed at the time of the meeting, which, in my view, with complete candor, that's the only time I think that they actually came to a point where they might say, well, at this exact moment, they may well be lawyers for the corporation that we're someday going to invest in. And that's the most you can get out of that meeting. That if you become an investor in these corporations, these are the lawyers.
When was the money actually paid in?
There was through the August of 2005.
Several months after your clients were done?
Yes, Your Honor. I don't believe that anyone paid any money in prior to the completion of our work. Certainly, it may well have been that the promissory note was used with someone, but in terms of the investment that I can recall, August of 2005, there were several people that played, October 2005, January of 2006. All after the work we did, and we were never called upon by anyone else. If Chad had called, I'm sure we would have done some work. If these investors would have called to ask for work to be done, I don't know what would have happened. But what I know is that both sides have to believe there's a relationship. And an ongoing relationship...
That's not actually true, all right? I mean, you can create a contract with somebody... Even if you believe you have not, if you've acted objectively in a way.
Well, that's a manifest, Your Honor, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Okay.
But I think that a lawyer should have some understanding that there is somebody he's representing. The appellants would like you to believe that all of these people, remember what he said, is that these people had an attorney-client relationship that was formed with these lawyers whenever they became investors. Now, I don't know how open-ended that can be for a firm that doesn't even know that they're even doing any more work for this corporation. I mean, look at... And when we think about... You know, I was thinking that probably McKinney, I think that's the is one of the best... Here, look, McKinney went to deposition with the lady, helped her fill out interrogatories, and yet the disciplinary commission said there wasn't an attorney-client relationship there. So how is it that you could show up for a deposition, help somebody answer interrogatories, and the Indiana Disciplinary Commission conclude that there wasn't an attorney-client relationship? That seems to me a lot more and a lot more manifest help than these lawyers than Bo White at a prospectus type meeting not saying anything. Not saying, oh, well, let's be sure about this. Because, Judge, what I infer is that you would have preferred that Mr. White said, well, everybody, let's not get ahead of ourselves. We only represent the corporation, and that's only if they continue to use us. I think that's the disclaimer maybe that would have make you feel better about that
this
part.
This really doesn't have anything to do with my feelings, Mr. Calamaros. When the lawyer knows or reasonably should know that the unrepresented person misunderstands the lawyer's role in the matter, the lawyer shall make reasonable efforts to correct the misunderstanding.
Right.
That's a rule that all of us who are members of the Indiana Bar agree to. Right?
I understand that.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
What I don't know that Mr. White had that element that you just said as a part of his consciousness or as a standard, when he's standing there with people who are not yet investors, and his role is only based on these two meetings that seem to imply that he's going to have a responsibility to help draft documents and have an ongoing relationship, that he would have the first part of that of those two clauses. Right? They're unrepresented people who are all who, what is it that they're going to think? Fine. And what is it that Mr. White thinks they're going to think? And those, I don't believe, are questions of fact that would bar summary judgment in our favor. He said what he believed to be the case, and he and his knowledge of the case, of what his job was, had been so far. Now, I don't think that you have an obligation to tell people, and we're going to be infinitely in some legal relationship with some corporation that may extend some duty to you over some period of time in the future. I just don't think that these people should be given that much leeway. Any other questions?
Well, thanks. Thank you, Councilman.
Thank you very much.
You'll have another minute if you'd like to take it.
What are you looking for?
Your Honor, in this transcript there is a quote that I don't have exactly, but it provides as follows. White, without any qualification whatsoever, represented to the group that the Citron Council would make sure that the Citron investor companies were set up and ran like a limited liability company should be run. Following this representation, Siebold, standing next to White and before the group in attendance, and while White was paying full attention, made a number of additional representations that White himself confirmed. White told this group that, don't worry, I'm going to make sure that this is going to be ran like a corporation. And the truth of the matter is, White lied to this group.
So your problem is that White, Beeman, whoever, didn't intervene at some point along the way, and I assume you know when that should have been, in hindsight at least, didn't intervene and say they're not running this corporation correctly and send out a warning to all the investors or something?
Absolutely.
You're supposed to be monitoring along the way how Siebold is running this thing.
I believe that an attorney is obligated to do anything for which a person reasonably relies on them to do. If he says, don't worry, we're going to make sure that this is going to be ran like a corporation, then we're not supposed to worry. It's going to be ran like a corporation, especially when the mayor is standing right behind you and we're in the...
Keep bringing this up about all this superficial stuff that other people around and the mayor and this and that, and this is why people... trusted somebody, I guess the mayor, I don't know what it is, but I just keep wondering where was the lawyer supposed to intervene?
Well,
I don't want to drag this out, but just that's just my concern, and I'll figure that out.
If I may, I believe that a lawyer has an obligation any time he makes an incorrect statement that he knows to be incorrect, that he has an obligation to correct it, and in his deposition, the last four pages, White was asked repeatedly, is this correct? He said no. Is this statement correct? No. Is this statement correct? No. You know that it's not correct, right? Correct. In fact, White never even took the time for 5 years to view the video until he sat down on the date of the deposition. White, I bring up the fact the mayor's there because you're much more likely to invest with the mayor's...
Thank you.
Thank you, Council. Thank you, Council. The case will be taken under advisement.